Trader Cobb Crypto Podcast. This is the Trader Cobb Crypto Podcast.
Hi there, everybody. Welcome to the Trader Cobb Crypto Show. It's an absolute pleasure and honor to have Joel and Marie on the show today. Now, Joel is an institutional investor with 20 plus years of experience investing across many different platforms and markets. Now, what Joel specializes in is looking for disruptive technologies, blockchain being one of these disruptive technologies. He's the founding partner, chief investment officer, and portfolio manager at Tereo Capital Management, and it's an absolute honor to have him here. Joel, please, if you could just let the guys know and do a bit of an introduction on yourself, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be here and have this conversation. As you mentioned, I have, through my career, been focused on disruptive technologies, and I don't know if there's been a bigger disruptive technology than the blockchain and the resulting cryptocurrency ecosystem. And we're very excited to be on this call with you to discuss this opportunity, not only for traders, but the institutional investor community at large.
Yeah, and look, my audience is going to be very, very interested to hear this because I know that I cover this subject quite frequently about the need for institutional money to come in. Like we've got in this space at the moment a very irrational and immature marketplace, very highly emotional. And that's because I'm not saying this is a derogatory term or a negative way of speaking to the people that are in the space now, but they don't have that experience that institutional money brings. Institutional money tends to make a decision and stick by its convictions, which means less volatility in many cases. Now, we like volatility as a trader, but as investors, we want to see volatility, but get in early, see the volatility start to minimize. I think institutional money coming in will provide us with that function that we need for this market to go from $500 billion into the multiple trillions, which I believe that we can see happening. Now, from your point of view with Tereo Capital, what is your play at the moment, Joel? What is your sole focus and where are you headed with it?
I would agree. So at the present time, I would say from a cryptocurrency standpoint, we're much more on the same side that you just mentioned. We're looking for trading opportunities, looking for arbitrage across exchanges. We're looking for use of more of a quantitative arbitrage algorithm type of strategy to take what I think are easy to make spreads at this moment in the marketplace. At the same time, we're also evaluating potential investments. Now, this takes a little bit more time. It also, with the information that's provided, many circumstances nowhere near what you would receive in the equity or fixed income market. So, being an advisor and really paring through a lot of the white papers, really trying to get to know some of the newer ICOs that are out there, I think we're going to see not only a difference in terms of the investor type, but a difference in terms of the opportunity set of what we can invest in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you touched on a couple of pretty important points right then. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned was the spreads, and the arbitrage. The potential there is right now. It just seems to me like the potential is limitless. Some of the spreads are insane, and some of the arbs opportunities are also insane. So hopefully you can hit the nail on the head with that, mate. With respect to what you're looking at, when you say talking about looking at smaller or newer ICOs, do you currently have a bit of a blueprint for what you're looking for? Because one of the things I think is holding the space back for institutional investors is value. As an investor, we look for value. If you're looking at trading or investing in a traditional market, there is so much data that you can look across. One of the ones that most people will be aware of is price to earnings or price to earnings growth ratios. It's one that's typically flouted around everywhere you look. Now, we don't really have those sorts of mechanisms at this stage in this marketplace. Are you looking to create that? If not, how do you find perceived value? Or is it just about getting in really, really early so your risk is greatly minimized?
I'm going to take your last statement and then work backwards. You're exactly correct. So look, the more valuation gap that I can create by being early, participating in a pre-ICO or an early ICO definitely gives me more latitude in terms of my ability to be wrong and still manage that volatility and hold a position for a longer period of time. With that said, you know, I do believe as time goes on, you know, we're going to continue to look for coins, you know, whether that's, you know, in the traditional currency space or more in the altcoin space. But I think you're going to see some more traditional abilities to be able to value as you start to bring coins that I think have some of the more traditional valuation metrics. And first and foremost, you know, is it producing a revenue? Is it producing an earnings? You know, is there an actual product? You know, I think we've gone through a period of time where, you know, a lot of these, if we compare it to the equity market, we're talking about very early VC type of a comparison. Whereas now I think you know, as time goes on, you're seeing much more prepared ICOs from a ready to, you know, come to market, whether, you know, on a comparison basis, that's a late VC, you know, late private round, almost a comparable to a real IPO with a real product, with potential revenues that you can measure, with potential earnings that you might be able to measure. And so I think both from a standpoint of actual products that we can evaluate, but also I think over time, us as investors are going to have to demand more from these companies in terms of what they're providing from a financial metric standpoint.
I couldn't agree more. And one little rabbit hole I'd like to explore with you, Joel, would be the revenue. Now, we've seen, you know, lack of revenue mania before, which is called the dot-com boom. Now, we are seeing some very, very close similarities going ahead now. I mean, we're seeing tokens out there that are, you know, or projects that are out there that are worth billions as far as their market capitalization goes. They still don't have a working product. They're still not turning over a single dime. And a lot of them are still trying to find an issue to solve. Now, with that being said, I mean, you've been through the dot-com. I studied the dot-com era, okay, because I was, what was I, 16, 17 during that period. I'm in my mid-30s now. So I wasn't trading it. I was watching what was going on, but I wasn't able to, you know, view it from a investor. I didn't have an investor head on my shoulders yet. It was the birthplace of that for me. The similarities, do you see major similarities? And because of that, is that affecting the way you approach this booming and very new space?
Well, there's some similarities, but there's also some vast differences. So from a similarity standpoint, I'm going to bring both, you know, that internet age, which I think is an important comparison. I'm also going to bring in the biotech age. And the reason why I'm bringing biotech is when you think about the combination of tech and biotech, you know, the lead time on biotech and the length of time it takes you to get a product to market is very long. And I think you're seeing that in some of these projects. So I think sometimes people forget, you know, and if you bring in kind of what I think of the three big pieces, you know, what is that total addressable market? You know, what is that revenue potential? But then the other side of that is how long is it going to take before we start to see some of these companies generate revenues? And does that make sense? You know, does it make sense in terms of what that market cap that they just raised in their most recent ICO, does that make sense relative to the capital they need to put to work to generate that product, or what period of time that they're going to need to generate that actual product to market, and is it going to fit into an addressable market that makes sense from an overall valuation standpoint? So I think all of those pieces are going to be important. I think they're good stepping stones for how an investor should think about investing in this space and thinking about not only ICOs, but coins in general of does this make sense for me to invest in? You can do the same thing, you know, with Bitcoin and Ethereum. You know, when you think about that addressable market from a money supply standpoint, you can look at M1, you can look at money supply from an emerging market standpoint, you can look at money supply from the markets where it's most appropriate that they likely continue to expand at the fastest rate, and think about what that potential size of the market is. So that is what we do. And I think it's a good, you know, baseline for how to think about valuation. And you know, I think that's one thing that I think a lot of investors, or what as you mentioned earlier, traders that we have in the space currently, they purely think about, you know, where is the space trading? What are the different coins trading relative to each other? And does that make sense versus a valuation of what the potential is? And that's the difference between a trader and investor. But I will say, I think the gap between how many investors you have in the space versus traders right now is pretty sizable.
Yeah, and I think it should be. I mean, look, you know, investing... Look, investing, you need to have good timing, but trading, you need to have pinpoint timing. If you're going to be trading, yes, you're going to be doing it properly, you need to have stop losses and manage your risk like an absolute maniac. That, I mean, trading is risk management, full stop. I mean, investing, yes, is risk management, full stop as well. But with trading, you are trying to pinpoint the exact moment in which something is going to either go up or down. Not only do you need to get direction right, with an investment, you've got to get direction right, but with trading, you've got to get direction and timing, because there's a lot of people out there, a lot of traders that got direction right and are dead set broke right now. So it's a combination of the two that I bring in, that I work with. I've been trading for a very, very long time in terms of my lifespan, percentage wise. It's pretty much what I know. And the investment side, I've also been doing that, but I've never invested in something more than I've invested in this technology. Not only have I built a couple of businesses around it, so I've thrown all my time into it, but I've also thrown considerable money into this space because I, like you, believe in myself to be able to spot a good thing when it comes across. And I see this as my dot-com moment, an opportunity to change the way things are done. I love to see progression. A prime example of that is, I mean, it's Uber. Yeah. Like I used to have to go to Double Bay a lot for meetings. I live in Bondi. Double Bay is like a 12-minute drive from Bondi. It's really, really close. I have to get a meeting often at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, try and get a taxi in Bondi at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Along comes Uber. I can get one whenever I want. It's easy. I don't have to tell them where I'm going, so they ignore me. This is a disruptive technology that has completely killed the taxi industry, and I'm all for that. I feel sorry for the drivers. They're the ones that get duped at the end of the day. But as an industry, if you turn your back on what the consumer actually wants and you totally ignore them, you have a monopoly, because otherwise your business wouldn't exist. If there was real competition, you'd be wiped out. This competition has come in and wiped them out. I see blockchain technology as a way to sharpen up many industries that have gone to sleep at the wheel, and they're driving through indiscriminately ripping people off or doing the wrong things. I really am excited about the investment opportunities from a purely capitalism point of view, but also the way in which we can sort of shape the next generation of business doers, of product providers, and consumer relationships. So I think it's a really, really exciting time. So when it comes to your fund and the institutional investment side of things, what is the biggest hurdle for institutional money right now to start to flood in? What do you think is the biggest hurdle?
There's basically two big hurdles. And I'm going to start with one, just to carry on from your last conversation in terms of how you think about a market that's as volatile as this as a trader versus an investor. So, you know, yes, I can trade that market, but as an investor, I'd like to have all the tools in my toolbox. And those tools would include my ability to short whatever coin I want to short, be able to use futures, options, et cetera, and have a full armament within my toolbox to hedge my risk in a particularly this market that we're in now where we saw this pretty significant drawdown. And that's not what we have right now. So having a full armament of hedging capabilities is first and foremost from a hedge fund standpoint. On the larger front, in terms of all institutional investors from long only to long short, the biggest thing, and this is in particular within the U.S., is a custodian. The custodian requirements in the U.S. are it's a pretty high hurdle. For you to receive an SEC approval as an institutional advisor and bring on client money over $150 million, that custodian relationship is extraordinarily important. And when the cryptocurrency space, you know, it's just completely different than anything we've seen in the past. So you have none of the top custodians that are involved currently. You really have to look for new entrants into the market space. And those new entrants, you know, have to do two things. They have to secure your information beyond anything that has ever been secured before, both from a standpoint of protecting your keys, but also from the standpoint of that anything goes wrong in terms of holding those keys, that they could be able to restore that in a timely manner. In addition, you want the timeliness of being able to upload from that cold wallet into a hot wallet as fast as you can and be able to trade as effectively as you can. And if I'm trying to, you know, put a significant amount of capital to work, you know, using algorithms, using arbitrage, you know, let's forget investing for a second. You know, I need that speed of and that efficiency from my custodian, my cold wallet to my hot wallet. And that's what, right now, I'd say we're only about 50% of the way there.
Yeah, and you also need market depth. I mean, that's one thing that that I sometimes struggle with when it comes to getting a position on, is getting the prices that you want at the time that you want can be difficult. It's much easier to be an investor if you're going to get a large position, because you can build a position. You've got your, you know, you're investing for a period of time. As a trader, I need to be in here. I can't afford to have much slippage, because of course slippage increases my risk, and therefore I don't, you know, the values of the trade are greatly diminished if the risk increases. Now,
correct.
One thing that frustrates the hell out of me, and it comes back to what you said about your ability with the tools like futures, options, and hedging, essentially, is what you're getting at. It's not just the hedging side of it right now. It goes beyond that. The issue that I have, and this is something that I would love to find the right person to work on, and I am endeavoring to do that at the moment, is to create a truly inclusive platform that traders can actually use. I mean, I'm used to trading foreign exchange, commodities, you know, bonds. I traded everything that moved. And of course, with that institutional grade investment class, you do get a wealth of information present at your fingertips, and you also get execution tools that are the best that exist. I mean, I can click and get whatever I want whenever I want with an entry stop and multiple targets on just about any platform that I decide to trade with. Sure, this platform might have a tighter euro dollar cross than this one over here, so I'll open an account with that one. But what it does currently is, I think what's happened in the market is that these platforms, let's call them platforms, they're trading platforms, they're brokerage accounts, yeah? These platforms have seen such extraordinary growth that they focus not on the product, but on onboarding people. If you've got a business where you've got to shut the front door because there are so many people coming through it, is your objective going to be, right, let's make sure all the products are better. Let's make sure we can raise an order with an entry stop and multiple targets at the same time for the client to have an easier use and minimize their risk and, you know, improve the user experience? Or shall we bring on another 100,000 clients and make another $100 million? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I think they've been more focused on bringing more people in, and because of that, we've seen the usability of the technology suffer. And I think that there is a definitely space right now. And if I don't necessarily want to create it, but if it's not going to be created by somebody else, then I'll bloody well do it because I need it. The ease of use for a trader to have the tools that I need. Like, I go from using a platform like TradeStation, for example, beautiful platform, works like an absolute gem, wonderful charting, everything I need right there. And then I go and have to use something like TradingView, which is a web-based platform. I can't even have it across all my monitors with all the screens linked. So there's a huge, despite the fact that this is, you know, amazingly advanced tech, i.e. blockchain, the execution platforms are still so primitive. And that needs to come up. With institutional money, I think they'll create their own. And that will give us the market depth. That will give us the volume to get the trades sizable enough for institutions to be able to play, aside from Bitcoin, Ethereum.
Yeah, and I'll take that a step further. I mean, you know, that's basically the project that I've been working with in terms of blockchain terminal. You know, that's the third piece that I believe institutional investors need, not only from a security and a compliance standpoint. So this is a non-web-based solution, But, you know, from where they are and from where they're going, you know, the ability to have the technical capabilities, the tools you need, the information you need to look across the market, all the social feed, the news, everything you potentially would want to use to trade cryptocurrency. And then the piece that they're working on currently, which goes to your point on depth, you know, right now, if let's say, you know, you want to trade 100,000 Bitcoin, you know, you're basically waiting for some guy on Twitter to throw out that, you know, hey, I got, you know, I got 100,000 or I got 50,000. That's not the way the equity or fixed income markets work. You know, ideally what you want is, you know, market makers, OTC, you know, would be basically be able to show you that offer through a system, your trading platform, and you can go out and access some of that. And that's one of the pieces that they're working and striving towards right now, is to be able to be able to have what I would use the term introducing brokers, introducing market makers with volume that really would streamline the industry and make this much, much, much simpler. There's people that out there that want to buy and sell in volume, and they simply can't do it right now.
Yes, I agree with you. And if they do, they get shot down because they say, well, why don't you do it over the counter? Why are you making the market dump? And whether it's fact, whether it's fiction, these people get crucified quite frequently. And you know what? It's in their rights. If somebody is an early stage investor, we see it in an ICO project, for example, they'll come out and say, oh, they've just dumped this much of that token. Well, if they didn't lock it up for a year within that contract, then that's just poor business practice. And this individual has every right to do what they like on a free market within the means of what they've signed. So they shouldn't be getting upset with the people that are trying to offload and lock in profits. They should be getting upset with the way the business is being run. And I think within this space at the moment, there is far too much talk about the token itself and the token metrics. And there's celebrity out there that has been created around systemized approaches to the token. Not many people are talking about the actual bloody business, because without the business being one that works, one that turns a profit, and one that has a reason for being, well, your token's not going to be worth anything. I think that's what's missing a lot in this space. And also, how do we value, without an income, how do we value it's almost like a Facebook valuation. Remember when Facebook came out, they said, oh, 100 billion valuation. Based on what? Based on future revenue. They've kind of paved the way a little bit in that space, where everybody knew that, yes, Facebook did have an enormous value, but we couldn't put a number on it because it hadn't started, you know, having that perceived value actually represented by cash in the bank, so to speak. We've seen that rollout. We've seen that in their ICO. We've seen the success of Facebook. And obviously, in the moment, in the press, there's a lot of negativity. But we still saw Facebook's share price surge, or the earnings surge recently in the last 24 hours. So it's a very interesting space. And I'm really, really interested to hear more about what you're doing with this platform, because it sounds to me like a little bit of a Bloomberg of sorts in the crypto space. Would that be about right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, a much earlier version, but, you know, that is the target goal, is to provide that institutional tool set that's giving you the security, the compliance, and the tools you need to trade effectively and efficiently. And I will say I've been involved from day one, and the speed of which they're developing that technology is surprising and shocking to me at how quickly they've been able to move and program and get to the point they are now. And I can't wait to see where it is in the next, you know, 3 to 6 months.
And I mean, you're obviously, you know, talking with other fund managers, other people in the space, traditional markets, you know, all over the place. Now, question that I have is, what level of conversation are you having with these people? Are you still the strange one sitting in the corner who, you know, they all swirl their scotch, puff on their cigar, pat their fat tummies and say, ha, 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 silly Joel, he'll never get this right. We'll just stay over here with our stocks and bonds. Or are people coming to you and going, hey, mate, listen, you're onto something here. We want to know more. Where's the level of conversation within your peers at the moment?
Yeah.
Relating to blockchain.
It's an interesting question. And, you know, and particularly as, you know, if I think where we are, you know, April of this year, and, you know, let's walk through a year ago. So a year ago, I would say that room would only be made up of, and even let's take it back a few years, you know, a few years ago, you know, it was a bunch of guys in a room with hoodies. You know, I think then you ended up, okay, maybe some traders from institutions that have stepped away and wanted, you know, this is a great trading space. Now I think you're starting to see some guys take a look at it. Are they involved? No. But are they evaluating the space from, let's call it, the largest institutions? And, you know, if you look at the news over this past week alone, we've had a lot of news in terms of some of those, not only large banking institutions, trading institutions, as well as institutional investors that are really looking hard at the space. And I think we're moving past the, is it real or not, to what do I need to do to actually participate?
Yeah, that's really good to hear. I've been having a number of conversations with fund managers, with not directly but indirectly with some sovereign wealth funds and whatnot, and there's definitely a lot more interest and a lot less it's hocus pocus. I mean, we've just read recently that Goldman Sachs have now put on a crypto trader as their head of crypto assets, or I'm not quite sure what they've termed it. They also, through one of their other subsidiary companies that they own, purchased a large stake in Poloniex, which is one of the biggest platforms out there to inject some more growth into that space and sort of polish it back up. What we're seeing is Goldman Sachs putting somebody on as a head of crypto assets, so to speak, that is a direct play from one of the largest institutions in the world. Now, what we were seeing prior to that, well, certainly what I was noticing, was that they were still making moves, but institutionally they were doing it under an umbrella. They weren't willing at the earlier stage, and when I say early, I'm talking like end of last year, early this year, that sort of thing. They weren't willing to come out and say, yes, we are in this space, but they were happy to buy or invest or be a part of through a company held by said institution that wasn't the same name. They're happy to dabble in that space now. Now, with somebody like, you know, we talk about Goldman Sachs, we talk about Barclays, HSBC, a lot of, and you'll know this as well as anybody else, there's a huge amount of wealth tied up within these institutions that are from small, wealthy families. They're high net worth individuals, do have a fair bit of, not power, but they're a very valuable client, because if you're going to get $500 million from one family, it's going to take you probably, you know, 50,000 other clients that are still relatively high net worth to get that $500 million. So, of course, they hold them closely. Now, some of these old money families do have old money values. So, therefore, for them to come out and say, we back this new space, this cryptocurrency, this crypto asset, this blockchain space, the competition is looking for any chink in the armor. And it could be as simple as a conversation saying, hey, listen, you know, these Muppets over here have lost their goddamn minds. They're moving into this hocus pocus, you know, World of Warcraft world, and moving away from traditional assets, which will provide you a yield of 3.2%, yada, yada, yada. And they can bring those clients across. Now, what I'm seeing is a shift, a little bit more aggressive plays coming from these huge institutions in the space. Now, I see this as being a really positive thing. Public involvement of massive institutions into this space. Do you see that continuing throughout the year? And do you think that regulation in the space will play a big part in that?
Yeah, so a lot of questions in that question.
Sorry.
So I'm gonna start with the, you know, thinking about more the wealth management aspect, and then I'll move into the regulatory question. So from a wealth management standpoint, you know, I that's one piece that we really haven't spoken to. But if you think of this as an asset class, and I've looked extensively on correlations relative to equities, fixed income, commodities, etc., you know, this is a space that is relatively uncorrelated. And so when you're building a portfolio, I think it's pretty easy to see, and let's add in a rising interest rate environment, you know, the coming off of QE, you know, how that impacts, and think about the last 10 to 15 years and the low interest rate environment you've been in, but you've had a very strong equity market. You know, how does a wealth management, financial planner start thinking about crypto as a piece of a portfolio? I think it's got a very valuable piece. And if you can manage that and manage that volatility and that risk associated with it, I think this is going to be an increasing piece of the puzzle that a lot of family offices and wealth managers are going to want to have a piece of. From a regulatory standpoint, you know, that kind of goes piece and parcel with a lot of what we've been speaking about, both from an institutional investor as well as that financial planner. You know, anything that we can receive from a guidance standpoint to help us with that custodial work, to help us with the security, and frankly, to help us, I think, it always helps to have some guidance from a regulatory standpoint in terms of what you can and can't undo from an ICO or an investment standpoint. But frankly, we can do some better self-policing, but I think it's also helpful to partner with some of these regulatory agencies and really start policing some of the bad actors in the space. The more bad actors we get out, the better it is for all of us.
So you talk about a piece, which I'm assuming would be a part there of your portfolio. Now, when we talk about the piece, I've just done a trip to New Zealand. I had a bit of a family holiday working, yada, yada, yada. We went all over the place. I was speaking with my mother and father-in-law, and some of the conversation with them, not just them, but other people that I was speaking to, was talking about the space, right? And the piece that you were talking about, which is how much of your portfolio are people willing to put in? Now, this is a pretty difficult question, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway, Joel. Bear with me. This piece that you speak of, what's your scope for that piece? Is that piece 2%? Is it 5% for the average investor? Is it a 5% portfolio? Is it 10% of that portfolio? How significant a piece of the average person or institutional portfolio are we seeing this space becoming at the moment?
So now I'm going to go way back in time and put on my early day financial planner hat, and and I'm going to give you all the risk caveats that I'll go before I give you some numbers. But, you know, first, we were speaking about high net worth individuals, you know, people that have that financial planner. So when I think about a portfolio where you would start to add cryptocurrency into, I'm thinking about a person that has a pretty broad, diversified portfolio to start with.
Yes.
I think when you start adding in the questions of what are you willing to lose, what are you willing to accept from a volatility standpoint, those help you gauge and start to triangulate what do you feel comfortable with. But if we're talking about an individual high net worth investor with, call it, you know, $5 million, $10 million, I see no issue with having it, as you mentioned, a 2-5% position in cryptocurrency, as long as those other caveats are met. You know, if they're okay with the volatility, they're okay with the risk in the space, because frankly, you just took a 50% haircut. You have to be okay with that and be willing to actually step in now and start thinking, you know, I'm willing to, you know, kind of double down on this. And I see this as an investable space. If you were just in this for, I thought it was hot at the end of last year, I wanted to continue to ride the wave, you know, that's, you know, probably not the space for you at the present time.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I want to double back on something that you mentioned before about, you know, the low interest environment with the high equity prices and the bullish market that sort of followed up to the start of this year. Yes, we have seen US equities, I say US equities because US equities is really the barometer for the Western world as far as the health of the economy and the greater market. The old saying is, if the US sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. It's fairly true. It's fairly relevant. Now, of course, with that, we've seen this is our ninth year of bull run since the GFC, or that was 2008 where it began. But, you know, we're in our ninth or tenth year. Now, markets don't go up forever. And anyone that tells you that they do is either trying to rip you off or fall, because they just don't know. You know, if this conversation comes up quite a lot to me at various events that I speak at and whenever I'm around curiosity, I shall say. But does the falling equity market boost crypto, do you think?
You know, if we think about it as a part of a portfolio, I think this is a great diversification piece, as I mentioned earlier. You know, if you think of an alternate investment vehicle that could potentially hedge against a falling equity market or a falling fixed income market. You know, with that said, I think it always depends upon the veracity of that drawdown. You know, you get an equity market that, you know, within a very short period of time, you're down, you know, double digits, 10%, 15%, 20%. That can spook people overall, you know, because I would tend to bet that, you know, there's a good chunk of the people that are invested in the crypto world that still have significant equity holdings, and getting hit on the equity side may force them to liquidate some on the crypto side. So I can't say that it would be completely insulated, but given what the market's already done, you would hope that we would see some stability even in the face of a declining equity market. Now, I'm gonna. With that said, I think it would be far more helpful, as you have, and maybe, you know, I'm gonna caveat the timing we're in. If you had institutional investors, if we could have a better measurement of, as you mentioned earlier, valuation and better valuation metrics to measure and have confidence in, then you can turn to and say, all right, we're at a point where this needs to stabilize here. You need to be buying this. That's a little more difficult in the market we're in today.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It'd be nice if they came together right now, because it would seem like the optimal timing.
Exactly.
So look, one of the things that I think is also relevant when we talk about falling equity markets, not suggesting that that's going to happen by any stretch of the imagination, but it will. Markets cycle. They go up, they go down. That's just the way the world works. That's the way capitalism works, and it will repeat itself. Now, one of the reasons why Bitcoin and this decentralized world was sort of founded was after the global financial crisis. And the global financial crisis didn't give many people an opportunity to have any choice. Now we do have choice from putting our money with people we don't trust. Now, the global financial crisis really taught us some things, which was people that are in high places will not be punished. I don't think anybody went to jail. No one was prosecuted the way that they should have been. There wasn't enough people responsible for this collapse paying the price. It was everyday investors. It was the superannuation funds of the world, the pension funds of the world, the investors. It was the mums and dads that took the hits, while all the big dogs went back on their yachts and said, ha, 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 I'm away with this. I'm fine. Now, that really caused, I was in London at the time. I was trading in London during the global financial crisis. I was actually short Northern Rock, which not many people know was the first bank to collapse under the weight fall very heavily and be bailed out amongst the first. And then we saw Bear Stearns, of course, then Lehman Brothers, and you know, the roll call continues. But what I saw over there was a lot of people get hurt significantly. I was working with a bunch of other guys in finance that I didn't work for an institution. I worked for myself, but we worked together, that were about to retire, and they're still working now trying to recover the money they lost. So a lot of distrust, a lot of frustration, a lot of anger was pointed towards these people, and they did not do anything about it. If we see another event like that, we see now we have a new market in this crypto asset class. Do you think that another cataclysmic correction and misuse of trust and anger coming from that, do you think that will push people really into the only other option, which is to take some control back of their own and go into the crypto market?
Yeah, and if you look at a lot of the survey work that's been done within the space by a lot of the participants, you can see it if you break up the various demographic age groups. So if we take, you know, the baby boomers relative to the Gen X, the Gen Y, millennial, centennial, et cetera, you can see that breakdown of where that distrust grows as the age drops. And so as time goes on, yes, I think those are the participants that probably continue to grow in the space the fastest. And to your point, you know, if we saw something, you know, to that extensive size again, it only probably accelerates that.
Yeah, and the rise of the millennials has certainly coincided very nicely with the rise of this new asset class space. I mean, I was speaking to another person earlier on today, talking about the fact that the younger generation doesn't seem to have too much of an interest in traditional stocks and shares. And we questioned as to why. And the conclusion was, I believe it's because they're in the social media space, which is the instant gratification space. They need instant results. They want to know now. They take a photo of themselves and they put it up online somewhere and they get likes, they get comments, they get that instant gratification. Whereas your generation and then my generation, we're more used to actually having to be patient a little bit more and to work a little bit more for our results. Cryptocurrency and millennials work out very well. Now, millennials are a very large number of people, and as they become voters and become more involved and start to vote with their money as well, the space is just so well designed for this new generation of careers, of investors, of technology experts to grow it. And I think that's an area where a lot of the growth we've seen at the moment has come through, a lot of that distrust in traditional markets, because they've grown up seeing their parents go through the GFC. They might have been, 12, 13 or teenagers during that period, but they felt that. Anybody who had a family member, an adult in their life, that adult was invested. So that adult felt pain through that. That distrust has now helped to create this market. And I think that's going to continue to gain momentum. And also, it's this younger generation that are tech savvy, that are the Silicon Valley of the world, that are now being drained into this blockchain community. Again, for the same reason, the massive gains, the fact we can change the way that the world operates, and it's a very disruptive technology. So I think we're kind of coming close to the perfect storm. Two things lacking: a bit of regulation to give us a rule book and a bit of an understanding for institutional investors on how to actually value companies. If we can get all those things coming together right around the time that we start to see a bit of a market dip in traditional markets, I think we've got the perfect storm. What are your thoughts on that?
I'll even add to that a little bit. So also, just from a size of that demographic group that you just mentioned, it's comparable to that baby boomer group, at least in the U.S. So your point is this group of millennials, centennials age up, the likelihood that they have a significant amount of capital to put to work in potentially a different space than what their parents and grandparents were invested in, is very possible. I would also add that, I think that distrust coupled with blockchain is going to be perpetuated in a lot of the ideas that you're seeing right now from an ICO standpoint. They're regaining control, and I'll add Facebook in there, regaining control of your name, your data, and who you are. The ability of blockchain to make you an anonymous person again, and to be able to control your data, potentially tokenize that data in various aspects of your life, but to have the data that you own, not where someone else owns, and continues to sell your data again and again and again. So I think it is about control. I'm going to give you one last piece. I think a lot of people, and call it my generation and older, while we believe in giving back, I think there needs to be more from a social understanding. I think this group also understands that. And I think it's a very important part, with my involvement as an advisor with Blockchain Terminal and some of the other ICOs that I've been involved with. There's just a real sense of community and trying to give something back to the world. There's that dual, charitable yet business side to this ecosystem, which I found very rewarding with working a lot of these companies. And I think that's something not to be dismissed.
Yeah, it's not a profit at all cost model, is it? Joel, look, I got one more question for you before we let you go, mate. I have to ask it because it's just something I always ask. As far as, you bring a huge amount of experience to the space, as we've gathered from the conversation, and your CV speaks for itself. But I mean, for anybody who is looking to get into not just investing, but investing particularly into the crypto asset marketplace, there might be someone who's a baby boomer who has heard about the space but doesn't really know what to do, somebody who's young and looking to get into it, or somebody who's basically just in the middle of their life and they just want to know what to do. What would be the major thing that you would say to them as a point to keep them safe or to give them information? What would be the number one point that you would say to somebody looking to get involved in the space?
I'll give you a couple of different points. So first, I think, some of the things we've spoken about, I think, are extraordinarily important. Really, trying to understand, does this market make sense? Does this product make sense within that marketplace? What is the place of that product? Is it truly differentiated? Is it truly disruptive? I think one thing I always ask before I, you know, really look at any sort of investment in this space, does it need blockchain? Is blockchain necessary?
Yes.
You know, and I think, you know, that basic question a lot of times isn't, you know, people are just slapping blockchain on everything, to run an ICO and get it done. You know, that's not necessarily necessary and probably is not going to be a good idea. I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunities in using blockchain in a lot of different areas, some of which we're not even, you know, utilizing yet. So I think that's the first piece. You know, does this make sense? You know, that kind of Peter Lynch, you know, does this product make sense? Would I use this product? You know, do I, you know, where how do I see this impacting my life? The next one.
Logic.
Yeah. Who am I investing against? You know, I think a lot of people think about every reason why they're going to be right, why their product's right, whether that investment is right, you know, but I think most investors, particularly individual investors, don't think clearly on the other side of that. What happens if I'm wrong? What happens, you know, if everybody, you know, is trading against me, is out before I am, is, you know, working against me, you know, who are those people? You know, and in today's world, this market moves really, really fast. And you have to understand that speed of how it moves. Understand, you know, is that the right space for me currently? Do I need to wait a little longer before I leg myself in? And then the final piece is, you know, back to those, you know, age old questions of finance, you know, what am I willing to lose? What am I willing to risk? How much volatility can I accept? You know, and does that make sense for me? And it really needs to be thought of in the context of an entire portfolio. You know, this shouldn't be something where you're taking your entire, you know, 401k, superannuation fund, you know, whatever your retirement vehicle is and throwing it all in crypto when you retire. You know, it really needs to be thought out well from a total portfolio perspective.
My absolute pleasure. I think that was a fantastic answer to wrap things up. Joel, look, one thing, mate, where do people find more of you, of the projects you're working on? How do they find more about all about Joel?
Well, I'm pretty much on most places, you know, LinkedIn, et cetera. You know, if you want to know more about Blockchain Terminal, which is, you know, the core ICO that I'm working with right now, it's bct.io, and there's still a few days left in the ICO. And I'll tell you, if you want a place to play this market and, you know, the tokenization, basically you're utilizing their utility token for taking a share of the exchange fees that they will make, the subscription model, as well as any apps on their open app architecture, you know, it's a pretty good way to play a growth of a market if that's what you believe in.
Well, it sounds like I'm interested, mate. I want to know more. But Joel, I appreciate your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here, mate. I really do. A wealth of experience, a huge amount of understanding for not just about the crypto space, but for overall institutional investment space. It's been an absolute pleasure picking your brain, getting a number of answers, and I thank you so much for your time, mate.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem, Joel. Thanks, mate. Bye-bye.
Have a good night. Bye.
The Trader Cobb Crypto Podcast. Check out TraderCobb.com because experience matters.